Like the conversations you hear on Basic Folk with your favorite roots artists? Then join Back Catalog Listening Party, a weekly podcast where you can dig deeper into their catalog. Top songwriters like Mary Gaucher, Chris Smither, Dar Williams, and Lizzie Ngo join host Mother Banjo and Anthony Earig to talk about their old albums with a live online audience. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and learn about attending live tapings at backcataloglisteningparty.com/join. Hello, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. It's me, Cindy Howes, and I host this podcast. Today, we are releasing the first in our series recorded on the Keyamo Cruise, which happened back in March. We got to talk to Mary Gaucher and Jamie Harris, as well as Susan Warner, John Mook. And today, we are releasing our conversation with Ani DeFranco and Carcy Blanton, which we're very excited to share with you. Before we get into that, let's talk about our mailing list. Are you on it? If not, you should sign up for it. It's a once-a-month email sent to your inbox to let you know what's going on with the podcast, who's been on recently, who's coming up, all of our folky thoughts and feelings about everything. You can sign up for that at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. We're also on social media. We're mostly on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, at Basic Folk Pod. You can follow us there. You can also find links to those in the show notes. Basic Folk is a listener-supported podcast. You can make a financial contribution and help keep the lights on here. Do that by going to our website, basicfolk.com/donate, or again, find that link in the show notes. Okay, how's it going? I am about to run out the door to meet Lizzie Ngo in Anchorage, Alaska, as we are doing a few live events in the great state of Alaska. I am like excited, nervous, worried, elated. I don't know what I'm getting into. I've never been to Alaska before. I'm really looking forward to seeing it for the first time. I have a couple of friends who live out there. We're going to be meeting up with our friends at the Parlor in the Round Concert Series and doing a few shows over the weekend. And I don't even know what's going to happen, but I'll post pictures on Basic Folk's Instagram so you can see what all took place while we did our shows in Alaska. Okay, let's get on to the show today. Basic Folk is Making Trouble at Sea with Ani DeFranco and Carcy Blanton. We had the opportunity to speak with the two like-minded radical songwriters on the 2025 edition of the Keyamo Cruise. Our conversation kicks off with Ani sharing her transformative experience performing as Persephone in the Broadway show Hadestown, delving into the challenges of acting and the lessons learned from stepping outside of her musical comfort zone. We navigate through Ani's journey of independence, discussing Unprecedented Shit, her first album with a producer in 23 years, BJ Burton, and what it means to relinquish control in the creative process. In Ani's memoir, No Walls in the Reoccurring Dream, she writes about how her creativity is aligned with her menstrual cycle. She described the most creative part of her cycle as the window. I got to ask all three artists on stage to reflect how their creativity relates to their periods. What resulted was a discussion on how creativity is impacted not only by menstrual cycles, but menopause and ovulation, and how that has evolved over time. The conversation also touches on the significance of hair as a form of self-expression and how societal perception of women change with their appearances. Ani and Carcy speak to the power of songwriting in addressing historical and political issues, emphasizing the importance of music as part of a larger movement for justice. They share insights on the necessity of community and collaboration among artists in a challenging industry, encouraging listeners to find strength in solidarity rather than competition. To wrap up, they reminisce about their parallel wild youthful experiences and how those versions of themselves continue to influence their art today. As Ani had to leave the stage early, Carcy brought it home with an Ani DeFranco theme lightning round. Thanks to Sixth Man and Keyamo for having us aboard the cruise and facilitating this great conversation. Let's get into it. This is Ani DeFranco and Carcy Blanton on Basic Folk.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming out. I'm Cindy Howes, and that's Lizzie Noh. We're from the Basic Folk podcast. We interview folk musicians. We have honest conversations with folk musicians, and you can find us wherever you get podcasts. We're produced by the Bluegrass Situation, and we are really honored to be here today with Ani DeFranco and Carcy Blanton. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay, great.
I'm ready.
Okay, Carcy, ready. First, a couple questions for Ani. You, about a year ago, did a Broadway run on Hadestown. You performed as Persephone for about 5 months, and we understand that you loved it. What kind of creative avenues have you been able to explore through acting? Will you do it again?
I did indeed love it, but that was just one of many adjectives. It was so hard. It was so hard. It really made touring look like a walk in the park. And it was challenging, super challenging. The acting was part of the challenge for sure. The direction that I had when we were rehearsing was very, and with that was a, that was another challenge, was to have a sort of a cadre of bosses.
Whoa.
Telling you how to do everything very specifically. That was a first.
That's not a thing that we
enjoy
in this business.
Yeah. In fact, that might have been part of the design of why we are doing what we are doing. So that was challenging. And in terms of the acting, I received a lot of direction to sort of proclaim, and they kept using the word Shakespearean because that was a cool word for say it louder, you know, and enunciate, you know. And I just wasn't, I wanted to do it like a movie, you know. I wanted to do it as real as I could. So things like that were challenging. I sort of had to prove myself in order to get some leeway, you know, to kind of massage it towards where I was feeling it. So the acting thing just kind of, I learned as I went, you know, and sort of found my way there. I was, as I tried to start really getting into it, into that moment and do it as real as I could, which is same with music, right? You know, you try to put yourself right in that place where you made that song and try to sing it from there. And then I would get out of time with the music, you know, because the spoken lines in Hadestown are over music as well. So it was like, be super real and in the moment, but on the beat, you know, like all the things. It was cool.
So, Ani, your independent reputation precedes you, but for the very first time in 23 years, you had a producer. BJ Burton produced Unprecedented Shit, which, round of applause for that incredible
great
album.
Record. It's really good.
In that process of working with BJ Burton, your first producer in 23 years, might I reiterate, what did you learn about giving up control? And also, what is the difference between being independent and asking for help?
Yeah, wow. Good question. That's taken me 23 years to parse that question for myself. And I think I took 23 years to learn how to delegate or say sure, why not? So that's a big part of the reason why I was my own producer for those first 22 records was, well, A, just not knowing anybody, coming out of a hole in the ground in Buffalo and just, you know, and, you know, and then I met one person and they played bass. And so we were a duo, and it takes a while, you know, to become a part of the world and know other badasses and know their phone numbers and feel like you know them well enough to ask for their help. So that was an inability to slow down, you know, just slow down and calm down. That was not really in my wheelhouse. So I just would just do it. And so I could get on to the next thing, you know, and working with other people, one of the things it takes is time and patience. And, but after so many years and decades and records, I actually had enough of my own ideas. I finally was like,
that's a good run.
That's generous. You know, there were good moments. There was good moments. There were a lot of learning moments. And I made my own mistakes, which I kind of, that was another element, I think. It's easier for me somehow to blame myself and not put it on somebody else. So I made my own mistakes. They're mine. And then at this age, I'm just like, I want help. And I know it. And so the process with BJ was really remote. It's very 21st century endeavor. We spent one day in the room together at the very end of the process.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah. So less than ideal. Mm-hmm. I'm not recommending that. But it was way giving over, you know, because I would record the demos and then send them to BJ and he would screw with them and send them back. And calibrating what he was doing from afar was hard. So it was really just a kind of a yes or no, yay or nay. So it was just, I just said yes, even though you just muted the guitar or turned it into a blurping sound or, you know, like, okay, sure. Sure.
So this is something that all three of you on stage can chime in about. In your book, Ani, No Walls in the Reoccurring Dream, which has anyone read that book? Amazing. There is a chapter about noticing how your creativity is aligned with your menstrual cycle. And you've described the most creative part of your cycle as the window. How has your window changed as you've gotten older, as your body has changed, and as your cycle has changed?
Wait, when is the window? Which part?
PMS, baby.
What?
You don't find that PMS is a driver?
My PMS is like fully in bed eating brownies for 10 days. 100% not creative, like TV shows only.
Wow.
Mine is like ovulation is like, oh, I'm interested in the world. Let's see about it. Let's go out there and have thoughts.
Let's go get some on us. Yeah.
For me, ovulation is for the upbeat country songs.
Oh, okay.
And the PMS is for the moody, what is the world even, folk tunes.
Yes. Yes to all of us.
God, bodies are amazing.
Hell yeah.
I mean, so, yeah, my window has closed. Years ago, closed. So, similar with the creativity, the songs, I could always count on them. You know, kind of on a cyclical basis, there was stuff to work out. And now I'm just like, I could write a song or not, really.
Wow.
Can I ask like a kind of related question?
Yes.
Because I know your music pretty well, Ani. I don't know. That's all I'm going to say about that. But I find for my songwriting process, my creative energy has been very tied to my erotic energy.
Yes.
And that a lot of my songs have come out of like love affairs. And I wonder if that's true for you. I can't think of any songs in particular, but I'm just asking.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think that's one and the same, isn't it? These passions that move through us, that use our bodies to become themselves and our instruments and our life. Yeah, you know, I feel like menopause is a blessing. I'm just going to call it a blessing.
Yes.
Let's go with that.
I'm not even going to use that balancing word.
Because, Can't wait.
I've had a long, good, solid run of curses. And I'm going with a blessing on this one.
Yes.
Especially because it's so, you know, looked down on. Like, you're mm-hmm. less than, you've lost, you're on, you know, you're done. And, I mean, for me, the blessing that menopause brought me is to not feel everything everyone in the world is feeling with them.
I'm looking forward to that.
Ooh, can't wait.
Thank you.
Seriously, yes.
Always having to ask, do I want to kiss that person or do I need to write a song?
Or do I want to punch them in the face?
Why does it feel so intense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful job mm-hmm. to feel with everyone. But it's heavy and it's exhausting. And so it's a relief for me these days, you know, it's so interesting to like, whoa, this is maybe more akin to the male experience for a lot of people in a lot of ways. Like, I can feel for you, but I'm not right in your body. I am, you know?
Like, you don't just have the screams of the death of capitalism in the back of your mind all day?
You know, it's just a little dial.
Sounds cool.
It is cool.
Yeah.
It is cool. So, less songs, but I'm okay with that.
You've got a lot of songs.
A lot of songs.
Yeah.
You're
one of the songiest, actually, of all of us. I am so excited to ask both of you about your hair. You are both performers who have had notable hairstyles. And I want to know what your different hairstyles have taught you about the way the world looks at women. And what have you learned about yourself as you've changed the way you present to your audience?
Okay, well, can I just say, first time I walked out onto the pool deck, I looked down and from behind, I was like, there's Carsey.
Yes.
Let me go say hi. Tell us about it, Carsey.
You know, honestly, it just grows out of my head this way. I'm not sure I can make this political. I think I'm going to kind of pass.
Great.
All right, I'll go there.
I think
Let's
it's
go.
More about what's in the head.
Yeah, well,
we gotta get India Ari up here.
Yeah. You wish. But what I found, anyway, I wish. But what I found was that in my 35 years of being out there, mm-hmm. that I was compared to in the press, in the music, in the, you know, by all the people who are supposed to know stuff and define what's happening culturally. Whatever my hair was like, that's what my music was like. And it was very much, you know, they only compare women to other women.
Of course.
And, you know, yeah. And it had everything to do with hair in a really weird, surfacey way.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know that I was intentionally trying to change my hair every week to go, oh, you think you know?
Right.
You think you know?
Yeah.
But I think something in me was operating that way.
Can I ask a quick follow-up? What was the feeling when you kind of first came out with the shaved head? Did you notice your audiences treating you differently? And did you feel different on stage?
Well, that was 1990, so there wasn't audiences. There was audience.
There was cool. like that person.
Cool.
There was just you. It was you. Yes.
Yes.
She's yeah. here. There she is. And so it was also like not, there wasn't a real cultural basis for that.
Right.
And so especially pale skin, mm-hmm. shaved head, skinhead.
Yeah.
Skinhead. That was weird. I went from, you know, 18-year-old long hair, hey baby, to like people crossed the street
mm-hmm.
to not walk past 5'2" me. With like looking like this.
Hey.
Again, yeah. The hair. you know, security, you know, people following me around drugstore, you know,
right,
me.
And you were like, tell me again, what did I do? Why are you scared of me? Yeah.
And like, I will never, of course, ever say that I know what the African-American experience is. But I was like, oh, because very quickly I was enraged. Mm-hmm. By, it's like, wait, I cut my hair off and you can't see me anymore. You literally can't see me. You're afraid of me. Everyone I talk to is uncomfortable. And, oh.
That leads really beautifully into a question I've been wanting to ask you for many years. Your 1998 song, Fuel, begins with an archaeological dig from the great shiny capitalist buildings of Manhattan down to the graves of the enslaved. And you talk about the packaging of ideas and music and culture in this very conformist right-wing media landscape. So this is kind of for both of you. You're both artists who treat American history and racial violence seriously in your work. What have your songs taught you about the power of songwriting to be a part of these conversations? And do you still believe that a song can make a difference in these critical historical moments?
It's a big one.
Yeah.
You want to go? You go.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would say yes and no. Mm-hmm. I think that I'm very interested in how songs and songwriters have been a part of organizing and about out of left movements through history. And I think that when we work together with a larger movement, then songs can be very powerful. They're very galvanizing. Mm-hmm. They make people feel uplifted in the hard work of trying to change the world. I think without a movement behind us, they sort of, the political aspect of the songs becomes almost aesthetic. Like, it gives people an excuse to feel as though they're part of something when they aren't. Mm. And so I think for me, it's felt vital to connect my work in music to my work in organizing so that it feels like, come on in, everybody, get in here and do work with us, rather than like, put this on in your kitchen and then you can feel as though you are resisting Trump or whatever.
Yeah. The music is not the end.
Yeah,
point.
I think the music has to be integrated into the larger movement in order to change things. That is my belief at this time in history.
Yeah, smart. I'll go with that. I guess for me, I'm almost just even doing less thinking about it. Like I don't know if this song is going to be somebody's excuse or somebody's lighter fluid or what. I just know, I just hope that it will be useful. Mm-hmm. But for me, all of those songs, it just, you know, the political ones are personal to me too, you know, you have to feel it deep to sing it for reals, right? So it's just that moment of feeling something and getting it out of your body to heal yourself and to transform yourself and to teach yourself through it. And that's all I can do, really. And then whatever the effect is or isn't, you know, is not up to me.
And to add to that, I mean, you've had such a huge effect on so many of us, and I don't want to make you feel weird, but like, I would not be doing this job without your songs. And
Neither
I know that's true also of Aeneas. We mentioned Hadestown, and it's true of a lot of people who are, you know, trying to carry the torch and do political writing. And so I hope I didn't, in my earlier answer, imply that you like lit a fire under so many of our asses. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, I'll calibrate my answer too in response to yours, because I didn't want to imply either that I'm doing it all in a bubble, because I think I would have stopped a long time ago if it wasn't for you and Aeneas and every other person that it meant something to other than me. Yeah.
So this question is kind of a 180, but kind of not a 180. You're each involved in so many projects. You have an impressive release schedule. We are living in a time where the vast majority of artists are having to work way more hours for way less pay. So while we're here at Kayama, we're at sea, there's no Wi-Fi. How has your relationship with rest evolved over your career?
Good. For those listening at home to the podcast,
just throw myself
everyone
into the
has lain down. We are crying. Yeah. We are not all right.
Rest. Oh, 2025 and rest don't really gel well. What's happening? I respect it now more than I used to. I used to have way more of the martyr thing, like rest is for chumps, you know, rest is for suckers, you know. And I have this brilliant friend, Valerie Kaur. Does anybody know her work? She's an incredible civil rights activist, writer, lawyer, filmmaker, badass. And she is very clear. Like, sometimes I try to email her and text her, and she's like, I'm on an island with my kids. And I felt in my body that, you're laying down. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at that, and I was like, you're still doing that, Ani. What the is that? That's a bunch of bull. Because she is smarter than you are. Because she will come back better and more able to contribute than. And I look back at my 30 years of trying to be there in the fight, and I go, whoa, you should have stepped back so many times when you didn't. But you stayed on that stage. You had nothing to give. You were confused. You were exhausted. You were not helping anybody. So I respect it. That's my relationship with it now.
Yeah. I'm definitely having a personal experience with this question right now. Like, I literally have stress hives right now, I think. I hope, in a way.
Is there a doctor in the house?
As a musician, I'm sure you have the best possible health care available.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, we live in America. It's like, what could be better? But I just want to say, too, like, on a more to bring it into the larger framework, I heard somebody calling that attitude that you're talking about, this sort of macho, which I think a lot of us women in the music business develop a kind of macho hardcore thing, because we're like, I'm going to fucking do this for my job. Get out the way. And maybe we have to just do that, and that's how we can do it. But I'm definitely guilty of overwork so far for my whole life and working on that. Mm-hmm. But I heard it called internalized capitalism recently. Yes. And I really love that phrase, because one of my favorite things about capitalism, and I have a lot. No, one of my least favorite things about capitalism is that in this system, a lot of things that should be rights are privileges, and rest is one of the big ones. So in this way of doing society, which is just one of several different ways we could do it, you kind of have to buy rest. So if you start out without money, you don't get to rest, and most people will never get to rest. And then mm-hmm. some people get the privilege of rest if they make enough money or work enough hours in their life. Mm-hmm. And I just think, I don't think that's a good way to do it. What do you guys think? Yeah. Let's not.
I feel like it relates back to the window, because I remember when I was in my 20s and I had long dreadlocks, my male friends would always make fun of me for napping whenever I felt like it during the day. And my perspective
still does, by the way.
I still do nap all the time, but it really rubs men the wrong way when you don't do the 9 to 5 progress, you know, like super productive schedule, and you need to take rests at different times throughout the day. But I think as women, our magic comes from, we get our energy in different pockets, and like, our society isn't set up to accommodate that. So sometimes to be a revolutionary, you just have to nap when you feel like it. Just stop, drop, and nap.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Ani's going to take off early, but we've got one more question that we'll do, and then we'll say goodbye. Thank you so much.
Maybe I'll just go listen from over there. Okay. What do you got for me?
You both had kind of wild childhoods. You were both off on your own very early. You had your own unconventional youthful experiences. How do you each relate to those wild young versions of yourself? Like, where do they still show up for you? What would your younger self think of you today?
Well, I am a mother of an 18-year-old gal now. So I'm reliving it in my mind, in my heart. I'm looking at her about to graduate high school and going, whoa, here we go again. It really feels like I get to do this. I mean, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to watch, but then I'm going to be there. But I feel that feeling again of endless possibility, you know, and she doesn't necessarily know exactly the 10 and the 30-year plan or whatever, which is school. But it's just that going into the world feeling that I think I carried far. You know, yeah. I rode that 18-year-old thrill a lot longer than maybe was seemly. But it's really cool to be feeling that again through her.
Oh, that's beautiful. Oh, yeah. What about you, Carsey?
I don't know. I've had an interesting journey with it. I was a very punk rock youth with my combat boots and my Ani DeFranco records. And I left home at 16 and lived with some, like, bohemians and didn't have a job. We were, like, busking and dumpster diving and hitchhiking and being totally broke, and it was super fun. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of was like, oh, perhaps I'll be a folk musician. And then kind of, like, I think in some ways I tried to turn it down for a long time because I couldn't find a way into radical folk at the time I was starting out, which was, like, 2007 or something. And it was sort of like, felt like the radical era was kind of like on the wane in a way. And the people coming up were like, I want to be pop, but I'm folk. And I was like, okay, I guess I'll do that. And then in the Trump years, silver lining is many of us have been radicalized anew. And so I found a way back into my punk rock youth and I'm loving it, except I am tired. That. That's the downside of being punk rock is exhausting.
It's a lot of jumping and sweating.
Yeah. So I literally was bleeding on stage. I don't know if anybody saw that. I had a cut on my knee and I was like, rah, and I was bleeding. I saw at the end, I was like, good. Wow, I'm really doing it.
Ani, we know you have to go and we want to be respectful of your time, but thank you so much for coming on Basic Folk.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
You are an icon. Thank you.
All right. Okay.
Carsey, pop over. We want to talk to you.
Up, Carsey.
Okay. Let's get into...
That was great. That's Ani DeFranco.
Can you believe? Can you believe?
No.
Let's talk about After the Revolution.
Great.
So,
here's what I picture. After the Revolution. Okay, so... I was kidding. That's the name of
honestly,
an album, but I was taking
free.
It regularly. Or literally, that's the word.
I get the sense you do take it literally, and that's... why we're here talking, actually.
Great.
Like Ani, you write songs that challenge people to look at these long historical cycles and our place in them, oftentimes in ways sometimes people might not be comfortable with. So what has this latest album cycle with After the Revolution taught you about what it is to be a folk artist and a radical folk artist in 2025?
Love this question.
I love your work and you.
Gosh. Well, so first of all, I'm going to take the end of the question first.
Great.
Because as I mentioned at my show, some of you have heard, I have been doing kind of a research project about the radical origins of folk music, of the folk revival, which was like almost 100 years ago now. There were a group of literally activists, organizers, communists, to be clear, who were like, we need to go gather the songs of the working people of this country because we need to celebrate their labor. This was like literally part of a political project. They're like, we're going to celebrate the labor of the working people. Mm-hmm. So Alan Lomax goes and gathers all these songs from all over the country. And then he and Woody Guthrie are buddies. Woody's like, I'm going to write a bunch of songs about the Depression and what it's like to be a working person. So originally they were all organizers. They were embedded in the labor movement, which in the 30s was really getting some shit done. Yeah. So it was like they were writing songs and singing them for striking workers. They mm-hmm. were they had all these study groups that were artists studying politics so that they could be more effective in the labor movement. So this is the origins of this music that we're still doing on this cruise ship today. So I'm very interested in how to look at the work that they did 100 years ago and make our labor movement stronger again, because our labor movement is not we don't have enough leverage to do anything to the people in power.
And that's
right
on
now.
Ronald Reagan.
It is largely on Ronald Reagan. Yeah.
Long may he burn.
But it's also absolutely 100%. Say that. But you know, it's also on the Red Scare, I want to mm-hmm. say, because in a way, Reagan was the peak of this thing that started after World War II, which was the number one goal of the U.S. empire became opposing communism. And it was about opposing the Soviet Union, but it was also about opposing the ideas and values that were in the labor movement. So there's a lot of stuff that's like there's an amazing document written by Ayn Rand that was, it's called The Screenwriter's Guide to Being an American or something. And this is like 1947, Ayn Rand's in Hollywood. She writes this document. She's like, hey everyone, we got to get the commies out of movies. Here's how we're going to do it. First of all, don't glorify the collective. Focus on the individual. Second of all, don't make poor people seem noble, because we know that the rich get their money by doing a good job and being great and smart. So there's this whole document that's literally laying out the rules for how to make anti-communist art. And it was in movies, it was in books, and it was in music as well. So I'm just saying that because I think we're still in history right now. And the stuff that we make now is influenced by the last 100 years of history, which has been a doozy. So I didn't answer the first part, but the last part was fun.
No, but I think it's a super helpful framing that you look at your music as a part of a movement for justice and greater freedom rather than the other way around, which is how we are encouraged to look at it in this industry. As, you know, you're an individual, it's hard enough to get, you know, credit and compensation for what you're doing. We're encouraged to like focus on our careers rather than how can the music be of use.
Totally.
So that, I'm going to be taking that with me.
Oh my gosh. And I have to say too, like it's been so freeing mm-hmm. to be released from that kind of mania where it's like every musician is out here trying to fight every other musician for a couple of shitty paying gigs. Like that
all
is not
incentives
satisfying.
Are gone.
Well, yeah, it also just like it hurts and mm-hmm. it's hard and it's exhausting. And for me, like to get back to the rest question, I think, mm-hmm. one thing I found that's really energizing is like being part of movements of artists so that we can all work together instead of all one at a time trying to like climb up each other.
And I feel like that's how we first bonded. We met at a festival and we were like, you're doing abortion work. You're doing abortion work. It was about the cause. It was about the values and the mission. And then the music is this incredible like glue that holds us together.
Yeah, it's just like a fun thing we can also do.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be our entire identity and like, please pay me more because I wrote a better song than that. Whatever. Mm-hmm. That's just such a, it's just a bummer of a way to think about life.
Yeah.
Who else is in your community of musicians?
Well, I have a few different, I mean, I have a few ways of answering that. So I have my friends that we love hanging out and writing together. I have my band. I'm very attached to my band. You guys, if you've seen
Same.
The show, you may
are
have
fabulous.
Seen.
Wonderful band.
My band are my best friends and we, you know, collaborate creatively, but also we like hanging out and we know each other's families mm-hmm. and we're in each other's lives and we spend holidays together. And that's all important to me. I like feeling like I'm on a team, even when I'm on tour. But I also have been working with an organization called Artists Against Apartheid, which is Great. A pro-Palestine organization. And if that pisses you off, that's okay. We can, please don't chase me down the boat yelling at me about it, though. That's just not an effective way to have a discourse. There's a great book about it called On Palestine by Noam Chomsky, and I recommend that. If you're like, I don't understand what she thinks, that's what I think. It's already in a book. They wrote
and
a better book than I wrote.
And we can link it in the show notes. So no
yeah,
need
link
to follow
in the show
up
notes.
IRL with Carsey.
No need to chase me down the deck of the boat yelling. That is to say, Artists Against Apartheid has been an international organization of artists where we mm-hmm. are trying to work together, put on events to fundraise for the mm-hmm. children of Gaza. We've done a lot of different events.
Were you part of Songs Not Bombs?
I was part of Songs Not Bombs.
Everyone go buy Songs Not Bombs on Bandcamp. The money goes towards children in Gaza.
Yeah. Also, I covered an Anais Mitchell song on that.
Beautiful.
Anais Mitchell is so good, right? Wow.
The best. Okay, we kind of want to call an audible and do a little Ani DeFranco-themed pop quiz lightning round. Oh, how do you feel about that?
Just about your opinions, not about, like, facts. About
I mean, anything. I probably could do either way.
Okay.
I love that about you. You start, Cindy. I've got one in mind.
Okay. In no more than five sentences, where did you first hear Ani DeFranco's music?
Oh, my God. I know this so easily. Okay. For my 13th birthday, I grew up in a really small town Virginia. Five sentences?
Okay. Yeah.
For my 13th birthday, I was given some cash to buy three CDs, and I had heard on college radio the song Buildings and Bridges from the album Buildings and Bridges.
Yes.
Bridge Club.
And so I bought that and Sheryl Crow's Tuesday Night Music Club.
Yes. Nice.
And Relish by Joan Osborne.
And here we are today.
Wonderful. Here we are.
Okay. In three words or fewer, how would you describe Ani's guitar playing?
Percussive. Muscular.
Yes.
Innovative.
Mm.
How many Ani DeFranco t-shirts have you owned throughout your life?
You know, I wasn't ever a band t-shirt person, and I now regret it. I would always just like buy the newest CD and go home. So I'm sorry, I don't have any.
Which Ani DeFranco album do you return to most often in your personal listening?
Oh, that's tough. Mm-hmm. Actually, probably Buildings and Bridges still. No, it's called Out of Range. Sorry. The album is Out of Range. The song is Buildings and Bridges. But just, I think, because it was the first one for me.
Hmm. Do you have another one?
I have one last question.
One more. Make it count.
If you had an afternoon with Ani to hang, chill, what is the location you would choose for your friend date? Thank you. I'm a professional podcaster.
I'm feeling like a backyard picnic under a tree, you know, bottle of organic wine so we don't both get headaches.
Oh, I love that.
Some cheese,
really great.
Crackers, fruit. That's what I'm picturing. It's a date.
Even a friend date is a date when it's with Ani.
Friend love can be romantic.
Sometimes it's the most romantic.
It's the most romantic.
Usually.
Well, Carsey, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you
so
much, Carsey.
You guys make my dreams come true. I can't believe we just did an Ani DeFranco interview together.
That was fucking cool.
Like a team.
Today's episode was produced by CJ Nungesser. Our music composed by Dietrich Strauss. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can check us out on basicfolk.com. You can search for Basic Folk in the SiriusXM app. Go to folkalley.com or on Folk Alley's mobile app. Or you can find us wherever you get your shows. If you enjoyed this episode, send it to someone who is working on the revolution. That person might need some inspiration from some heroic women of the stage in Carsey and Ani, and they'll listen to it and be empowered, and we'll move further along in our society. Thanks a lot for checking out the show, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.